Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Happy Pod from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in this edition, uploaded on Saturday, the 3rd of May...
It was just really odd and unusual that we couldn't find her anywhere. We, you know, tore our house apart trying to find her.
The cat, whose love of boxes took her hundreds of kilometres from home. Also, the small sticky patch that could save lives as an alternative way to give vaccinations.
There's been a lot of excitement about the result. This is really now moving the field forward to something that now could be game-changing.
We'll also hear about the killer whale calf trapped in a Canadian lagoon and how it finally swam to safety.
It was just extraordinary. I was beside myself. I was so proud of brave little Hunter.
It felt wonderful to know that she finally had a chance. It's incredible.
Also in this podcast, we hear from players in a blind football league that's helping to tackle discrimination in South Sudan.
When I'm playing, I feel like I don't have disabilities. I'm very happy.
And we hear from listeners about the joy of moving to a new country. Now, each week, the team here at Happy Pod headquarters have an uncharacteristically serious debate about what should be the main story. This week, though, the conversation wasn't too heated, as there was universal agreement about the news that really mattered. And that, of course, is the tale of the cat, which mysteriously went missing in the US for a week and turned up hundreds of kilometres from home. Galina usually spends her days indoors with her owners in Utah, but was found inside a box at an Amazon warehouse in California. My colleague Nick Miles spoke to Galina's owner, Carrie Clark, who described first their alarm that their pet had gone missing.
It was just really odd and unusual that we couldn't find her anywhere. She's an indoor-only cat, and she's also the kind of cat who, like, always stays by my side wherever I go in my house. We, you know, tore our house apart trying to find her. Everything that we looked into, every possible idea that we could think of, she was just nowhere to be found.
Okay, so further down the line, days pass. You must have been getting more and more desperate. Tell us what happened.
Yes, so 7 days passed. We had gotten friends and family together searching for her. I started to give up and lose hope, feeling like I would never find out what happened to her. And then miraculously that afternoon, I received a text informing me that Galina's microchip had been scanned. And within 30 seconds of receiving that text, I got a phone call from a mysterious caller who told me that they had my cat Galina and she was currently in California, which is 650 miles away from my home in Utah, her home in Utah. And so we eventually found out through the caller that she was a vet in California and Brandy Hunter had found her at the Amazon warehouse. They take their time sending the returns back. Unfortunately, the reality of it was that Galina was trapped in that box without food and water for 6 days. Wow. And
how on earth did she survive? I mean, that's a huge amount of time without
any
water.
I know, it's a massive... There were so many miracles that led up to her surviving. Like the first miracle was that the box that she was stuck in, that she was trapped in. Well, first of all, it was a really, really large oversized box and it had five pairs of steel-toed boots in it. What ended up happening, I have to kind of backtrack a little bit. When my husband boxed up the package of the boot, he like checked the box and made sure everything was in order. And then he closed the flaps and walked over to another room to get tape and scissors. And when he came back, he just put the tape over the box, assuming everything was fine. The only thing we could think of that must have happened is that Galina had snuck into that box.
So Galina makes her way back home, ultimately. And what was the reunion like?
Being able to be reunited with Galina is something that I will never forget. We, right as we heard that she was in California and we heard the ordeal that she had gone through, and we just, you know, flew out to see her as fast as we could and bring her back home to us because we just adore our cat. I'm so happy she's okay now. That's what matters the most, is she's okay now.
Are you going to fit her with a GPS tracker now?
Yes, she's wearing it right now. She's actually by my side at the moment. So now she is wearing a collar with an AirTag on it, and I can track her with my phone. We're so happy to have her back home. And if I could just say one last thing, please consider microchipping your pet. That's the way that we were able to get Galina back to us. And to triple check your packages that are delivered out.
Carrie Clark, and I've got to say that if that cat has nine lives, I reckon it's presumably used up at least two or three of them. Next to a small invention that could have a big impact, saving lives around the world. And can I be honest, it's also rather welcome news to me personally. It's a bit embarrassing, but strictly between you and me, I have a real phobia about injections. So I was delighted to hear that medical researchers have come up with an alternative. It's a patch, a bit like a sticking plaster, that you can use to give vaccinations. Now, it's aimed primarily at children. But in fact, it could help adults too, because unlike the liquid they put in hypodermic needles, the patch doesn't need to be kept cold, so it's possible to use it in remote places which perhaps don't have refrigeration. The device has just been successfully tested in the Gambia by a team affiliated to the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I spoke to two of the team involved, Dr. Mohamed Yisa and Professor Ed Clark, who first explained in more detail how it worked.
So rather than being given with the normal needle and syringe to the normal injection that people are used to, the same vaccine is embedded within these tiny microneedles, so to speak, on the back of what looks really like a sticking plaster. And the microneedles penetrate the skin, so they go through the skin essentially painlessly with some very minor sort of sensation. They dissolve very rapidly and they deliver the vaccine.
So is this just a matter of convenience, something rather nice for those of us who don't appreciate needles very much, or is there more to it?
One critical benefit is that they're easy to administer by people who are not healthcare professionals, that they're expected to be easy to administer following very brief training by volunteers. The other, perhaps most important advantage, again, from our perspective in West Africa, is that they don't need to be stored in the fridge in the same way that normal vaccines do. So this means it's easier to reach the most hard-to-reach vulnerable populations of children who may be a long way from standard healthcare facilities.
Mohamed Yisa, if I can bring you in here, I know that medical scientists like you can spend years and decades pursuing a line of research all for nothing and or not much significant gain. How's it been to see that this does look like it's going to benefit an awful lot of people?
It's always good to see that the efforts that you have put in has such potential to change lives around the world.
Be honest, Mohamed, when you were doing this trial, were you pretty confident that the patch was going to work, or were you really waiting with, I don't know, bated breath to see if it really did have the effect you wanted?
When we started the trial, the technology itself was very fascinating, especially because it had a lot of promise of being pain-free and all that. So I was hoping for it to work because of the advantages, yes. But I have no idea if it was going to or not.
Ed Clark?
We were obviously the first people to see the data here in the Gambia, so it was a really big day, and I remember looking at it with my colleagues. This patch has been developed over actually decades by colleagues in the US Centers for Disease Control and other organizations. So I know, you know, when we gave the data to them and showed them the data, it was a really big day, and there's been a lot of excitement about the results since.
This trial has you using the patches to deliver the vaccine for measles and rubella, but I mean, are you going to be trying to use it for other vaccinations that would be important in that part of the world?
There is a real drive now. We've got this data and a lot of interest in using these patches or this technology for delivering other vaccines. The same similar technology has been used in adults already, in fact, just to deliver flu vaccines in the US. So this is obviously a very different population.
So if it is left to me, I would like to see maybe every other vaccine on the schedule delivered by patch. Maybe the option to choose needle and syringe or a patch. That's one thing I would like to see. in an ideal world.
This is really now a big hurdle to moving the field forward from those first ideas to something that now could be game-changing.
Ed Clark and Mohamed Yisa. It has the honour of being the world's newest nation, but South Sudan has had more than its fair share of troubles. It was born out of a long war to win independence from Sudan itself, with victory finally coming in 2011, and has been beset by its own divisions ever since. But if there's one thing that unites South Sudan's disparate people, it's a love of football. Indeed, despite suffering poverty and ongoing violence, football still looms large in people's lists of concerns. And more recently, a different version of the sport has been gaining popularity, with the launch last year of a Blind People's Football League. Rebecca Wood reports.
A shout from a teammate.
Nice one, nice one, yeah, captain.
Good. And a goal. The sounds of a football training practice underway. But these players can't see their teammates, the goal or the ball.
I'm called Jimmy Jess Augustine, and the nickname is Messi. It was in 2012 when I lost my sight.
My name is Jonas Abre. I was a player before in one of the division teams in South Sudan. So it is very unfortunate I got blind.
In a sport where sight has no place, sound is everything. Simon Madul is head coach and technical director for the Blind Football Premier League in South Sudan.
We have five players in the field. The goalkeeper is someone who is sighted. So also act as a guide.
And I shoot! Nice one, nice one.
And we have the coach, which act as the guide in the middle of the field. And most importantly, our ball has a jingling sound inside. And also there are some words that we say. For example, if a player is attacking, he has to say boy.
Boy, boy, Moses.
Because you cannot just come silently trying to attack.
Set up during COVID in 2020 with help from the organisation Light for the World, from small beginnings it's gone from strength to strength. No mean feat in a nation torn apart by conflict.
We started only with two players, but today we are reaching hundreds now. The sport is for people who are visually impaired. But we also think that it's very important for us to also train people who are not visually impaired.
Raising awareness of disability inclusion in ways like this and challenging the stigma faced by the nation's disabled population is the aim of the league, as well as having a positive influence on the lives of people like Yona and Jimmy.
When I'm playing, I feel like I don't have disability. I'm very happy.
I got blind. From there, I stayed 2 good years at home. Even I don't know what to do. I lose hope. Now I'm feeling so proud.
Of course, it's not just in South Sudan you'll find blind football. It's been a Paralympic sport since 2004 and has more than 60 internationally recognised teams, with Argentina, Brazil and Japan top of the men's leaderboard. For Simon, Jimmy and Yona, heading abroad is their dream. And while that may seem a far-off goal for now, they believe anything is possible with growing interest and team spirit.
A lot of people, they enjoy our playing. We come from a different state, different tribe, but through this blind football, it has united us. We're like family.
Good! Very nice! Nice one, captain.
That report from Rebecca Wood. Coming up in this podcast...
We gave them a bell, and when they rang the bell, then the owner would come over and present them with a tablet. And there was profile photos on the tablet, and the parrot could use their tongue to select a profile photo on the screen.
The highly social, tech-savvy parrots.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions, because it's not a natural environment for survival.
5 incredible women...
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In the last episode, we asked for your stories about how moving to a new country has made you happy. Well, Shirley Markutainan got in touch. 20 years ago, she swapped Texas for El Salvador. Not too far geographically, but worlds apart in other ways. Shirley left with her husband and two young children to help open a new facility for a computer firm. She told the Happy Pod's Isabella Jewell why they decided to make this move.
I grew up a military child, and so I was used to living abroad, and I just think the excitement of it, learning a new culture, and I wanted to expose that for my children too. You learn something different than you've grown up with. I think our biggest issue became our language. The children started school, and the school spent half their time speaking Spanish, doing history, math, all in Spanish, and then half the time in English, so that the other people that were from El Salvador would be learning English at the same time. So we were the opposite. We took Spanish classes the whole time, and I think at the end I was okay.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the other culture shocks you might have experienced moving? It's obviously a very different place from the States.
El Salvador can be a rough place. We tried to think of it as living in a big city. There's probably places you can go to, can't go to. So when you go to a grocery store or if you go to a pharmacy, you'll see a lot of armed security guards, even on the beach. I think that for a little bit, it took us back. But then it became quite normal. Time. Oh, that's a big one. In the U.S., you're very conscious of time. So you arrive to a party. You know, if they say the party starts at 7, you probably arrive a little before 7. And that never happens in El Salvador. And it took us probably a couple years to realize that, you know, people are much more relaxed about time. Even 30 minutes late is okay. It was a much more relaxed approach to things. You don't get so uptight about everything.
So would you say coming away from that experience, you're happier now in your everyday lives because you've borrowed aspects of the culture from El Salvador?
We are definitely happier. And I think that we look at things differently.
And if you had one piece of advice to someone or a family who wanted to move to the other side of the world or to a different country, what would it be?
I would say definitely do it. It's an opportunity for you and for your family. Think about where you're going to live, where you're going to send your children to school, and how you're going to approach it. If you're going to move to another country, embrace it. Learn all you can. Don't try to stay in a bubble and just stay with your own culture and your own ways of doing things.
Shirley Markutainan, and if moving to a new country has had a positive effect on your life, we'd love to hear from you. Now, the name killer whale isn't exactly designed to inspire sympathy. It sounds more like a creature from a scary movie. But despite their menacing name, killer whales, or orcas, spend most of their time eating fish, and they're very rarely a danger to humans. On the contrary, they seem to inspire intense affection from those who get to know them as individuals. That's what I learned when I heard the story of a very young killer whale who ended up stranded in a Canadian lagoon. The mother had died, and her orphan daughter was nicknamed Brave Little Hunter by the local community. And they then got involved in the many attempts to rescue her. I learned all this from Rob John, who comes from the Ihatisat First Nation, and also Jared Towers from the whale conservation group Bay Cetology. He explained first why there was some urgency in getting Brave Little Hunter back to sea.
Being that killer whales are social animals, they really rely on other killer whales to thrive and survive. And unfortunately, being that this killer whale is in a very unusual place, it had a very small chance of connecting with family. Also, being that it was only a 2.5-year-old calf, we were a bit worried about what kind of food resources were there for it.
Rob, John, what was the reaction of the community that you live in to the presence of this orphan killer whale?
It was definitely the top of the list of conversations. People lined up on the beaches just to view the incident.
Now, you then jointly, as a community, tried to rescue the killer whale, tried to get her out to sea. How did you go about that?
We have found a recording of whale's great aunt, and if they hear another killer whale, then they usually want to socialize. And the whale swam in the opposite direction, almost like she potentially knew that it was a hoax,
that tried and tested method didn't work and the other methods hadn't worked either. How were you feeling about this?
I think we were feeling the pressure. Those of us on site really cared. You know, giving up was not an option. So we were pretty dedicated and focused.
Rob John?
I was very concerned with the whole situation. I just continued on feeding her, visiting her, and singing to her.
You sang to her?
Yes, I did, yes. While I was in my little Zodiac, my small boat there, I was out in the lagoon with her and feeding her by hand. I was singing to her in our language and using our culture.
Rob, there's all these elaborate efforts going on to coax brave little hunter out to sea, but then it seems she just went of her own accord. Is that right?
It was a long-fought effort. You know, after we established a good connection, my coworker and I, you know, she was coming to the boat, she was following, and she was feeding straight from the surface beside the boat at this point. And we guided her to the sandbar, and she was still reluctant to travel over the sandbar. So I started going back and forth over the sandbar, just showing her that it was safe.
How did it feel to see brave little hunter back out in the sea? How was that for you?
It was just extraordinary. I was beside myself. I was so proud of brave little hunter for gaining the courage at each obstacle that she had to go through. She put her trust in us.
Jared Towers?
Well, it was amazing. It had been over a month, and it felt wonderful to know that she finally had a chance. And it still feels that way. It's incredible.
Jared Towers and Rob John. It's 24 years since UNESCO named its first annual World Book Capital. And the United Nations Education Agency has just selected the latest one. It's Strasbourg in eastern France. The idea of awarding the title is to promote reading, and that's certainly something close to Strasbourg's identity. It claims to be the city where the first ever newspaper was produced back in 1609. Lucy Atchison asked the mayor of Strasbourg, Jeanne Barsayen, what winning the title meant to her.
Oh, I must say it was a very powerful moment. My colleagues and I were overjoyed because Strasbourg becomes the first French city to receive this label of World Book Capital UNESCO.
Why is it so important to you and to the city of Strasbourg?
Our city, Strasbourg, has a very long history with books. We are the city where Gutenberg inventing printing. And so it is very important to us because it means the history of our city, but it's also its future. And we want to say with this label that with books, we can also promote debate, we can change the world. And so it's also about the power of books.
What are you hoping it will mean for the city in terms of long-term positive impact?
This label from UNESCO is about promoting books and reading in all forms and for all ages. It's also to fight illiteracy and inequalities. And so we also use the opportunity to give new books a location in schools and nurseries so that this amazing label could have a long-term impact.
Have you been inspired by other World Book Capitals? Of course, most recently, it was Accra in Ghana who were awarded the title.
It is an international network of 25 cities. We welcomed a big delegation from Accra. The mayor of Accra is also a woman, and it was a really strong moment between us as she gave me the flame of the World Book Capital. And of course, what the other cities did in the past was for us a big inspiration, and we will keep in touch. And it's also a great partnership to come with the next World Book Capital next year, 2025. It will be Rio de Janeiro. They came also to Strasbourg, and I can wait to go to Rio to give the flame to the mayor of Rio next year.
Strasbourg Mayor Jeanne Barsayen. Now, when you're away, there's a good chance you'll have caught up with family, friends or colleagues through a video call. It's a much more personal way to connect than a text or an email. New research from the University of Glasgow in Scotland suggests this isn't only true for people, as Anna Murphy's been finding out.
Hello? Who's there?
Daddy!
Yes, you heard it correctly. Those are the squawks of two parrots talking to each other via video call. They're taking part in a study into the way that animals could use the internet to connect with one another, much like we do. Now, I'd love to play you some more of that video and to tell you the parrots' names, but we've been told we need to protect their anonymity. The lead researcher of the study was Dr. Ileana Hirsky-Douglas.
Initially, we did a lot of research where we connected parrots together online through video calls, and we trained parrots to use our video call system, and we found that all parrots would use this video call system. But it was a lot of work for their owners. You know, they had to set up the call, sometimes a parrot was busy in another call, all these different things that can go wrong.
Oh dear, the classic problem of clashing parrot social schedules. But Ileana had an idea.
Then I thought it might be interesting to connect them to videos instead, because these are a lot easier. You can just play these in the background when the parrot requested, and these can be used for a long time, so the other parrot doesn't need to be available, for instance. But we didn't know how they would perceive online calls. Do they perceive them the same with a video? Do they know another parrot is live?
Well, the findings suggest that yes, they did know. The 9 parrot participants seemed to prefer the live chats, as they spent far longer making video calls than they did watching the pre-recorded ones. Now, the important thing to note here is that it was the parrot's choice. They were trained to, at least in part, be in control of their own social lives.
We used a system where we gave them a bell, and when they rang the bell, then the owner would come over, present them with a tablet, and there was profile photos on the tablet, and the parrot could use their tongue to select a profile photo on the screen. We did a lot of work around training them to use this system, and also we then did a stage of introductions. We called it meet and greet, where each parrot would meet each other online.
And as it turns out, the parrots even formed friendships, and just like us, preferred calling some parrot friends over others. So it seems to have been an enjoyable experience for these 9 parrots, but what about the wider benefits of this research?
For parrots specifically, because they do live in these large flocks in the wild, but traditionally in homes they live in much smaller groups, we're hoping that something like this could potentially give them some social benefit. And then if we start looking at this wider, we have lots of other animals that we keep either in our homes, zoos, aquariums, or various different situations, which don't have access to the number of animals that they would in the wild. So I really see the animal internet or animal video calls as potentially expanding an animal's world, much in the same way as expanded ours.
Ileana told us that as well as chatting, the parrots groomed, sang, and played with toys together whilst on the calls. But there was one more question I just had to ask.
What were they talking about? Do you have any sense of what they might have been discussing?
No, it's something I would also like to know. What's the topic of a parrot video call?
So for now, what the parrots were talking about and who these parrots were will have to remain a mystery. I suppose we're all entitled to our privacy.
Anna Murphy. Now, we'd love to hear from you if you have any pets who'd like to do video calls. And that's all from us for now. Remember, if you'd like to be part of the Happy Pod, you can email us any stories to share that will make us all smile. As ever, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Graham White, and the producers were Anna Murphy, Holly Gibbs and Rachel Bulkley. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, 5 mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
5 women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in these environments.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.